In only 2 days, you can move your career further, faster with a Harvard DCE Professional and Executive Development Program. Advance your leadership skills, craft smarter business strategies, build your network, and move your career in the right direction. You'll earn a certificate of completion, add Harvard to your CV, and become the leader you want to be. Our intensive programs are designed to fit into your busy schedule. Attend online or on the Harvard campus. Search Harvard Professional and Executive Development to learn more.
Explore the depths of your curiosity with aerospace engineer John Connolly, Columbia Space Center's Benjamin Dickow, and CEO of Heavy Metal Magazine, Matthew Medney, as they bring scientists, engineers, and authors on a journey of discovery. This is Putting the Science in Science Fiction, where fiction and science collide.
So welcome to Putting the Science in Science Fiction. You have Ben Dickow, Matt Medney, and John Connolly here. Ben, last week, which would have been recorded about 40 minutes ago, we talked about how we talked about how John got a relatively large promotion for his successful work on the helicopter apparatus that is now working for the Mars lander. That's and he wants to say it's not just because of that, blah 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 blah, but you can stuff it, John. But his new title that we're running with, that is his unofficial title sanctioned by his overlords at Lockheed, is Celestial Ground Support Lead, Deep Space Division.
Ooh, very nice. That's cool. That's great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Sure. That's better than like Rocket Propulsion Engineer 2 now or something like that. So that's good.
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, it was a job that I was shadowing and sort of apprenticing under someone for several years, and I had hoped to step into that role, and they moved the timeline up significantly. And I said, sure, just I will Pocahontas swan dive into that deep end.
Yeah, and John is oblivious to nuance, right? They pushed up that time table a week after the thing that he built for Mars worked really well. He doesn't put those things together the way
they did an organization reshuffle.
Sure.
I think there was coincidence, but okay. All right.
Sure. Exactly.
Speaking of which, by the way, speaking of that helicopter, it still hasn't flown yet though, right? Because it was delayed from Sunday.
Correct.
And then it was supposed to be 2 days ago and everything. Okay, cool. Just wanted to make sure.
Yes.
I didn't miss anything.
But all the mechanisms that I worked on executed correctly.
Yeah, I mean, listen.
That had to do with the deployment.
One of my friends and board members of the Space Center is Deanna Trujillo, the flight director for Perseverance. And she, you know, we were talking, you know, last week about this, and she's been sending videos of the testing and stuff like that. It's pretty cool.
It's the coolest. So John, set the tone with what you were reading today, and tell Ben what you were about to say pre-recording.
Oh, so there's a recent report that UMA-UMA, which is the interstellar object that visited our solar system in 2017, they've been trying to explain the acceleration that they were seeing as it was leaving the solar system, because they were not seeing the type of outgassing that would have been indicative of a comet, and therefore the sun side portion, which is receiving radiation from the sun, which is evaporating, creating thrust. So now there's a theory that UMA-UMA was a nitrogen iceberg that was a portion of an exoplanet that eventually got sent sunward. Whether it was part of our exoplanet group or another, no idea, no ability to differentiate. And they were trying to say that the nitrogen would have been more difficult to trace in terms of outgassing. But it would also say that given the acceleration, they would have required a tenth of its mass to be lost in order to satisfy the rocket equation and conservation of momentum. And they would have been able to see that. That would have been a tremendous amount of material. And so it really is still kind of, I don't know. I think it's one of the weaker stabs I've seen trying to, not, or A lot of times I feel like we see these things, they're kind of, you know, we have these extraordinary possibilities that seem to be defying physics as we understand it. And then we have somebody come in and say, like, well, no, it was this and this, and it gets disproven. And this time it just didn't really stick. And so I don't know, that makes me still feel pretty strongly that we should go check it out. And I say that because I have read there is a study called the Lyra Project, which was conducted after Oumuamua had arrived in the solar system to determine if we could send something to go visit it. And it's determined that we can, that there's, if we developed a nuclear thermal rocket, which we have the technological capability of, but we've never tried, then we could have a ship with a high enough specific impulse that if we left by 2030 and used a Jupiter assist, that we could get there by 2044. And I just think that it would be worth it to see, you know, if we're wrong, fine, but
what would be a good
reason to spend money ways
to develop the thermo propulsion system. So that's cool. Is there, so
exactly,
wait, what's the latest on where this thing came from? So they don't, I mean, not necessarily what it's made of or anything like that, because that's the question on the table, but like how far out they think this came from. No idea.
Okay. They can't speculate because along any given trajectory, there's enough stars that it could be from any of them, or just any from them, but it could be any number of ones.
Well, honestly, too, like it's both not surprising and surprising. What I'm going to say next is that, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there, right? There's an unimaginable amount of mass and things. So it makes sense that something's going to fall, you know, kind of come through our neighborhood sometimes. But at the same time, there's also a lot of nothingness out there. So it is surprising that something comes through at all. I mean, just on that alone, I think that would make sense to me to send a little probe out there and see what it's all about.
I mean,
I remember when seeing pictures of it, what I was going to say, sending pictures of it always makes me think of Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
Absolutely.
That probe, that weird sort of, you know, probe thing. And then we send somebody out there and it starts talking to our whales or something like that. So might as well try it.
No, I mean, because I would hate.
So
I just hate if we were wrong. You know, if it was Interstellar.
Sorry, Matt. Well, go ahead.
No.
You can't let that reference go.
I was gonna ask why you said the whales.
Well, because that was the probe, and that's the Voyage Home, right? That's number four. Where that's the thing, that this weird sort of dark, kind of cylindrical but also not very finished object just comes into Earth's orbit and the probe thing, and it starts trying to talk to the whales, and there's no whales in the 23rd century, and so it creates this like stormy disaster on the planet, and then so Kirk in the ship in time to 1986 and get the whales and bring them back so they can talk to this probe, and the probe goes away at the end. And the renderings of this Oumuamua object look very similar to that thing.
But now they're describing that they think it looks more like a disc.
Oh, really?
Than a cigar. Yeah. It definitely still is much, much wide. You know, it's very narrow in one dimension, very wide in another one. But that doesn't really, I think, change the nature of the mystery of it.
Yeah.
I think it's still, But to your point, when you're looping back a little bit, yes, there's tons of objects out there. I mean, there's the Kuiper Belt, there's the Oort cloud, which goes, you know, more than a light year out. And you know, when we talk about all these dark exoplanets like Sedna, and you know, they're trying to calculate based on our understanding of gravity, you know, where, you know, there could be other ones out there, but it's so dark and it's such a big space, you never see them. who knows? But yeah, I mean, I agree that with the science, like, I could see on one hand, I totally believe that there is these exoplanet remnant pieces that could be coming into our atmosphere. But I don't know. I also was currently listening to, I don't want to butcher his name, so I'm not going to say it, but one of the recent astrophysicists, he works at Harvard, who was the one who was avidly supporting that Oumuamua was an interstellar object from an intelligent civilization. And I just think that, yeah, there's enough questions that we've thrown at it that it's stuck, that there's enough mystery to it, despite how much people have tried to disprove it, that at some point just being like, okay, we're going to try. We don't need irrefutable scientific evidence to prove whether or not we want to go explore it. If we did that every day, we wouldn't explore anything.
True. True. That's a great point. And I think, you know, it kind of goes, what we both love so much about For All Mankind is that it's about the whim of the possibility of what could be, not about waiting until you know.
No, right? Absolutely. I mean, the fact that, here's a perfect example. One of NASA's upcoming plans is Lunar Trailblazer, which is a series of lunar orbiters that would be searching for water ice. And here, on the other hand, is For All Mankind, and you have Ed Baldwin and you have Molly Cobb on Apollo 15. It's either 1970 or 1971, landing at Shackleton Crater and rappelling down the crater side using the wheel hub of the rover as a winch to go find if there's ice down there. I mean, in some ways, I'm just like, wow.
Because it's of its size, and because we're not really sure where it comes from, but it probably comes from, you know, someplace way beyond. I think that should be enough to give us a reason to go explore it, or, you know, go check it out. Because, you know, how often are we going to get this opportunity for something kind of large like that? I think.
You mean like having an interstellar sample of anything?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
No, absolutely. Because we have all of our assumptions of planetary models and moons is still based on our solar system, even though we've talked about, you know, the compositions of stars can vary wildly, mm-hmm. and you know, planets that are primarily water, planets that are based a lot on sulfur, ones that mm-hmm. have much less iron, or just, you know, wildly different combinations of materials. Yeah, mm-hmm. I want to know too. I want to go in the way that OSIRIS-REx went to Bennu. Get me a sample and beam back what you. I mean, it's going to be from far, you know, far beyond Pluto, I think, by the time they would have to catch up to this thing. But
And
that's its own logistical challenge too. Sending something fast enough, but still large enough to be able to transmit back, and the infrastructure mm-hmm. for that.
Mm-hmm.
Matt, you good?
Yeah, I thought I had my do not disturb on my computer. Clearly. Clearly, I did not. Sorry about that.
Oh, okay. You had a worried face, and I was like, were we treading onto a topic?
But... Well, no, because a call came to my computer, and I was like, what's happening here? Mm. I told it, do not disturb on, but clearly my technology is not as good as the stuff that we imagine, and it did not activate the do not disturb. Unbelievable. I want to derail the conversation into these UFO sightings that were just confirmed. Have you guys seen these things?
No.
Ben, have you seen this?
No. They were confirmed?
It's freaking wild. So if you go, Joe Rogan posted the article to his Instagram, so that's just a good place to grab it from. But basically, I don't want to miss.
But where's the article from?
So there's a ton of different places covering it. So the Telegraph out of the UK is the one that Joe posted, but Fox and a few other US publications also confirmed that these images of these, tell me if this sounds like a TV show we all know, pyramid-shaped spacecrafts are being sighted and confirmed by the CIA that they are real photos, that they do not know what they are, that the photos are legit.
I did just see this.
So the Ga'uld.
But they came back and they were just like, nah, it's not worth it. There's fun.
Are you looking it up right now?
Fun days of early Egypt are done. Did we talk about that? Or Matt, did you send me that meme? That was the 6-part one where it's humans conceive of AI, humans perfect AI, AI perfects itself, AI rules humanity, solar flare destroys AI, humans worship sun god. And in my mind, the only conclusion I have is that The Matrix is a prequel to everything.
That's what we don't need, though, is nice. Another Matrix episode.
We don't. I agree.
That's cool, though.
So, I mean, what do you guys think is going to come in the CIA report that is due in a month? Are you familiar with this, Ben?
So I mean, I'm not.
There has to be
obviously not super familiar, but yeah, I don't know. I feel like this has been teased since 1947. I always wonder, like, what's the advantage of sitting on this information? What has been the advantage for 70 years of sitting on the information, right?
Mass chaos, or the anticipation of mass chaos.
But then why release it at all? Why even tease it? Like, you know, what's the point?
Because I'm playing devil's advocate here. Because they couldn't hide it anymore. Or because, you know, even trying to bury, I mean, as much as I could believe that the US government, if it really wanted to, could bury something pretty deep. Maybe if they tried to bury it, they felt that it would be that much more suspicious. Or it just doesn't matter or it doesn't matter that much. Whatever the information they gleaned, they deemed is not still an issue to national security. So therefore, it's also like how real is the threat, or not threat necessarily, but just I also remain highly skeptical. I don't know necessarily why. Yeah,
that's the thing. Is like
I'm all in. I'm 2 feet over the line. Take me to your leader at this point.
Well, why don't you talk about that a little bit? What do you think's going to be in that? What's going to be revealed?
I think that if you look at the jumps in technology from different eras, 1910s to 20s to 30s to 40s and on, the jump from the 10 to 20, and then the astronomical jump from effectively from World War I to World War II, the jumps are not really, they don't make tons of sense. You can kind of, I guess, you know, say like, you know, transistors and propulsion just grew exponentially in those times.
I'd say the wars themselves.
But Occam's razors, maybe someone just gave us the technology. It's probably, you know, probably more simplistic. And
simplistic, but I'm going to stop you there because I'm going to say, okay, how does someone take vastly superior alien technology and incrementally apply it to increases of technology on Earth? I mean, you know, why not? Then do we see a leap from the steam engine to fusion?
But we did. The reason that we haven't seen the leaps that you're referring to is because of capitalism, not because of a lack of technology. People are trying to mine money out of the current technology rather than invest into future technology that might make them more money. They're trying to gouge as much as they can today. I don't think that has any bearing to the leap of technology.
You're saying, you know, because you could make more efficient technologies, but they wouldn't be making this much money by the nature of being more efficient.
Exactly.
Which, I mean, that is
just the same reason why iPhones, you know, Apple is notorious for having three generations of iPhones ready at any time and slowly releasing them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's just like the perfect manifestation of that, just on another level.
Well, how many?
So when are you saying that the secrets were revealed? When did this whole timeline start? 1910?
I think it's like June. Well. No. I'm
June
saying...
17th. No, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm saying when the COVID relief bill was passed in December, there's a provision put in there by a congressman that said that they had to declassify all UFO documentation by like June 5th this year.
But here's the question.
It's pretty amazing.
Oh, no. I meant the time. What
you're saying about my timeline? I was just saying that, like, the type of warfare, right? You can, using World War I and World War II as just moments in time, the fundamental changes in warfare are so drastic for only a 20-year period. It's a little peculiar. Mm. There's no science to back it, but the type, you know, trench warfare versus aeronautical warfare and the way in which that it evolved that quickly without, you know, smaller wars erupting with those technologies to almost refine a world war is just interesting.
Well, I think it makes
sense. Honestly,
though.
There was a. Yeah, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. You're handing that off to me? Okay, yeah. Sorry.
That was important.
I didn't pick up on the cue. Sorry.
You're
that.
Not. You're probably not actually below me in the sequence. Of...
No, I'm not. You're pointing at Matt. I guess what I was going to say is that there is a pretty. Like, that's one storyline in history that I feel is, like, a pretty, pretty linear storyline. Like, you look at, like, mid-19th century Industrial Revolution and look at sort of political theory that's going on at the time. It's sort of this, the way that that industry was starting to push back against monarchies and things like that. And when you finally get to World War One, which that is the war that I think changed warfare, you know, basically
agreed from start horses to planes.
Yeah, exactly. Not just the mechanization, yeah, trenches sure, but still the idea of it's an all-out civilian population, the whole shebang. And then what happened in the interwar period and how that all of the sort of ideas around World War One and the mechanization, World War Two was just sort of like, there were airplanes in World War One, so it just World War Two. We had 20 years to kind of refine the technologies around that, but really the basic ingredients to World War Two were being played out in World War One, and there were some skirmishes. You know, the Spanish Revolution, or
yes,
I don't know if it's a revolution or what.
Yeah, the Civil War.
Was, you know, a lot of that was a crossover of World War One techniques and what became World War Two sort of tactics and strategy. I think that I'm not surprised by that so much. I am in awe of the fact that we as human beings are capable of that kind of a leap in history, that at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, there's this like complete like explosion of, you know, psychoanalysis starts looking at people in different ways and our identities of who we are. You know, relativity, you know, Einstein is there, and these sort of ideas of you know, what relativity is and sort of shaking up Newtonian physics, just all of that stuff, and how it every level of culture, of Western culture, was kind of kicking in this sort of weird way. Yeah, it's amazing that that's there. I'm not ready to say that it was because of alien technology.
No, I think it's because of the wars themselves. Just the
sure,
collective,
yeah.
in the way that I think collective crises can focus effort that at those times and in that time span where a lot of people lived between both of those wars. Everything is, as you say, that leveraged off of World War One into World War Two, But I mean, by the end of World War II, we made the definitive. I feel like World War II ended with a definitive statement of, and welcome to the atomic age. You know, everything about conventional warfare that had been fought in World War II and the way that we fought it was instantly neutralized, because if that war had continued with that weapon, how long would it have been until we used a nuclear weapon on an army? And just, you know, we have...
Ben, question for you. Have you been to Berlin?
No. No, that would be great. Why do you ask?
So I'm looking for the documentary on Netflix for you to watch as well, and I'll find the name in a moment here. But I promise you, if you went to Berlin and went to the aeronautical museum and saw the way in which their planes evolved, and then watch this documentary on the technology of Nazi warfare, the only thing that makes sense is aliens.
That's good. That's I would love to go to Berlin and I'll watch the documentary, but that was a good setup for a great punchline.
How could they have lost? How could they have lost with alien technology? That is BS. No way you lose.
What do you mean?
How does the side with access?
Who's to say that? Whoa. Wait, John. Who's to say the aliens wanted them to win?
So
why would you make that assumption?
So the aliens give them superior technology, so they think that they can win a war. So they attack Russia foolhardily. And then get their ass.
And I'm just saying that I don't know one way or the other. I'm just saying that the assumption that they would be given technology to secure a win, I think you're doing a lot of work for them.
Well,
you know what this makes me think of is a lot of great science fiction and alternative history stuff that's out there, including Captain America. It's not alien technology, right? It's not alien technology.
But it is German.
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's a storyline. But that's a storyline.
The Super Soldier Serum is German made.
Yes, and the Tesseract. Done. Yeah, and the Tesseract is not. So that's a...
No. But the scientist who created it—literally, you just made my point, John, by saying that it is literally alien technology mixed with German ingenuity. That is the Super Soldier Serum. You
it
just
is,
made
it's
my
the
entire
alien
point for me. and just to close the book on the other part, Ben, before we go on, it's Nazi Mega Weapons is the name of the documentary.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
it is wild. You watch that documentary and literally you just like, because they show the weapon, they show like concept and then final weapon. You're like, there's no bleeping way that you just figure that out
it's
in 3 years.
It's the Goblin Bomber. It's the super weapon that they have in Iron Sky that comes up from the moon. They power with the iPhone.
Oh, I love it.
It is amazing,
right, so
though. I mean,
the super soap.
Wait, before we do, I just want to like close the loop on one thing as far as like capitalism and all that kind of stuff. So I think that, so in the capitalistic side, I do think that post-war, everybody was trying to do something new, and I don't think we had the same sort of like stagnation in technology that you were talking about, Matt, at, you know, in the, let's say 10 or 20 years after World War II, because everybody, you know, was all brand new. We wanted to do new things and keep pushing the envelope. When those things started to pay off is when I think things slowed down a little bit. Cause I think you're right that there's a certain aspect of economics that says, you know, don't keep pushing for new if people keep buying the old. But also, you know, the astonishing amount of time between developments. You know, we've talked a lot about Apollo 11, and again, like, mystified that, you know, really that program started in around 1961, and within, you know, by 1969 we were on the moon. almost whole cloth. And, you know, you kind of look back on, like, let's say the atomic weapons in the Manhattan Project. You know, Fermi has the first sort of controlled fission reaction in 1942, in the winter of 42. And by, what, 2.5, 3 years
August
later...
August of 45.
It's not controlled. Yeah, August of 45, we're weaponizing it. So there's... I think that that is because you had this... Both Apollo and the Manhattan Project, you had a huge amount of state capital being poured into this thing. And it's like... Let's get everybody's on board here. Let's get this thing going. We've got to do this.
I couldn't agree more. So, and then you go to the moon and you find Optimus and you stop moon missions.
Yeah,
I get it.
But also to that point too, I think that
it's good. It's good.
I was gonna say,
throwing bombs. That's what you're all about.
But no, to that point, I feel that technological progression carried itself through for another decade too, because think about, you have 1969, land on the moon with an Apollo. 1979, you have the shuttle, mm-hmm. which is a complete – I mean, I think that in terms of capability of the type of craft that it is, that was still – it still kind of boggles my mind to think that the shuttle was existing as far back as the late 70s. And then I think we hit a type of plateau there. Because that progression, I feel like another 10 years after that, or by the time we got to the turn of the millennium, we should have been, and I don't know if we should have been on Mars, but we should have been establishing a lunar base by then.
But that was, isn't that part of the premise of For All Mankind a little bit too, is right?
Yeah.
So it's, you know,
it's 83.
And I think I've talked about this before there. Yeah. But I mean, you know, I have good relationships with a lot of engineers who worked on Apollo and shuttle, and as much as they were happy to work on shuttle and it was great, it was also a big bummer because they had all of that stuff on the drawing board ready to go to continue Apollo way past, you know, 1972.
No, and there was a decision.
And all of that stuff was, there's a decision made almost 6 months after after Apollo 11 to say, we did this. Now we're going to cut the funding for the program and switch it all to shuttle. And it was as much a political decision.
I believe it was Nixon's decision. And that's where I lay a lot of blame. Yeah, because even in For All Mankind, Matt, you see that in the part where Von Braun is explaining what their next phase past the Saturn V was. These mega carrier rockets that could do essentially like the SLS now, you know, be able to carry a Mars insertion craft. And this is 50 years ago. I know it's, but that does loop back. You know, okay, at that time, NASA was spending about 5% of the GDP. We also know from that time that there was tremendous public support. There was also tremendous public,
the public lost interest
as well. It was the nature of, you know, how do we justify spending this much money on this? But you know, you get to this point now.
But that's also what we were talking about last time, John, where I said public opinion should not drive exploration.
Agreed.
You know, public opinion didn't drive Columbus sailing the ocean. Nobody even knew he left, right? Well, it was just like effectively the royal
family. It was a shot in the
dark.
It was, okay, we financed this mission. We basically write off all these three ships and these people as lost. On the off chance they find something, we get first claim at new land that no one else has touched, which is, I mean, yes, you can take that metaphor and directly extrapolate it to space.
but also, you know, the King Ferdinand wasn't beholden really to anybody or to many people. So it didn't matter if people knew or didn't know. It was like, hey, this is what I'm going to spend my money on, kind of a thing. You know, in late 60s, early 70s, the U.S., it matters who's going to get elected in 4 years and what public opinion is about how we're spending money. And, or, you know, if you're the guy coming in and you inherit the Apollo program, and you, not only do you get to be the guy in charge to make the phone call on the moon and all that stuff, even though you didn't really do anything in the previous 8 years, then you want to put your stamp on a new program and say, hey, we're going to change gears. This is my administration. We're going to do a reusable spacecraft.
I hate that, because I wish that one, continuity. And even in that respect, I would say even right now, I would rather wish that Biden does not dismantle at all anything that Trump set up. As much as, and that's not to give Trump a political win. I don't give a crap which president was the one. But now, you know, now that we're here and we're still moving towards it, and we need, I wish that NASA was a public, it was more of an independent entity in the way that the EPA theoretically should be. And that it was capable of making its own decisions that weren't really, didn't have anything to do with the president. And on top of that, you know, I wonder if we move toward, you know, right now we have governments of large nations, generally are the ones that are capable of launch capability all the way up to a spacecraft. And you have,
well, we have an anarchist society from a world point of view. It is. It's an anarchist government structure.
Yeah, in the sense that there is no true, the UN doesn't wield true power.
Exactly. Exactly.
No, yeah, I agree.
Exactly, because if the UN did hold the true power, there'd be a collective space program that would actually share resources and actually create some sort of tangible impact on the space program.
Let's throw this theoretical instance. Let's say NASA was somehow the entity and its resources broke away from the US government or became a private entity that then fused with SpaceX and Blue Origin. So like, the
isn't that it already? Like sorry to interrupt, John, but isn't that kind of what SpaceX is? Is it trying to be it's trying to be NASA without being connected to the government, although they still get most of their budget from the government.
But that's the loophole, right? Is that you know SpaceX has the capability of NASA, which Lockheed and Boeing don't, without the red tape. No offense to you, John, you don't have the same capabilities that SpaceX has, right? Yeah. And did you see, to that point, Ben, did you see what happened, what got awarded today? The moon mission was just awarded to SpaceX today.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. That's totally nuts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think it's in a good way, Ben, but
I think
still,
you're 100% right.
Yeah. It's amazing what's going on in that sense. I before we close out this, because I know you want to go to the next topic, just need to acknowledge that we're recording this a few days at the end of the week that began with the 40th anniversary of the first launch of the Columbia Space Shuttle, which was the first space shuttle launch. So speaking of shuttle, we are 40 years out from that launch. And of course the Space Center, which is on the site where those shuttles were designed and built. We did a little thing about it earlier in the week. That wasn't a plug. That was just a history lesson.
And wait. Also, no, but I do. But it made me think.
Wow.
To plug, are you allowed to hold on a sec, John? Calm yourself. Ben, are you allowed to say who the guests are that you have for the upcoming? Or did it happen yet? What we talked about off air with a certain prolific scientist and a certain basketball player.
That already happened.
Can we talk about it?
Yeah, sure. If you want to watch the footage, it's on our website.
So for everyone listening, and then we'll jump into Super Soldiers, Ben moderated a Bill Nye, the science guy, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar science conversation for the Space Center, which is the coolest thing ever, bridging that gap. So if you want to listen to that, please go to the Space Center's website, Columbia Space Center, California. I don't know. What's the actual URL, Ben?
ColumbiaSpaceScience.org. And if you go to city, actually, the easiest way to get there, because it's part of our City of STEM program. This is a program that we started a few years ago that basically celebrates all of the STEM of Southern California for a month. So cityofstem.org, you can go there and check that out. Also, though, it was recorded as part of Bill Nye's podcast, Science Rules. And he's actually going to post a longer, I think it's a 45-minute version of the conversation. So you can go to either one. But it's cool. It was really,
that
really
is
cool.
A plug, and it's a cool plug. And you should definitely go listen and watch that.